Welcome to The Lore You Know, a show where we chat with some amazing human beings who are storytellers, collectors, and folklorists as we discuss the history of, inspiration behind, and importance of recording and sharing regional tales. And today I have with me the amazing Micah Hanks. Thank you for coming.
It is my pleasure, as always, to be here with you, my friend, and good to see you again.
Yes, good to see you. It wasn't even that long ago that I got to see you and get a hug.
Yeah, we were in the beautiful wilds of Western North Carolina. And again, I was just glad to have been able to host you and the Small Town Monsters crew down here in my neck of the woods, as we would say.
Yes, thank you. We loved it. Had a great time there. And also, if I'm not mistaken on what I saw online, your birthday was recently, yes?
Literally the day before I saw you guys. Yeah.
Oh, so, really?
I mean, yeah. But, you know, I mean, when you're, you know, my age, which is ancient, right? I'm 41 as of this year. And so even though I don't feel like it, which I guess is a plus, but I mean, you always just move the birthdays that are midweek right on over into the weekend. You know,
right.
I think that's standard practice. So yeah, it was business as usual. And then we went and built a bonfire and found blue ghost fireflies just a couple of days after I saw you guys. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because those are specific to your region.
They are. I mean, as I understand it, I think in parts of Florida, as well as North Carolina, and I'm sure other, you know, areas, other states, other regions too. But right around mid to late spring, these little guys, which as I understand it, are actually a rare variety of beetle, they will appear. And I guess this is their mating season. When they show up, I mean, literally, you're just seeing like these tiny little, you know, kind of off-white is really more how they look. They aren't like a vivid iridescent blue or anything. When you photograph them, there are some interesting little tricks of the light, depending on whether you're using a digital camera or not. And sometimes the coloration can even look greenish. I've seen in photographs some of the pictures that I obtained, which were rudimentary at best, Heather, but I mean, they nonetheless showed that kind of green effect. But to the naked eye, these things look like a kind of off-white, pretty dim, and you'll be walking in the woods. If you had a flashlight, you'd almost never see them. But it's if you're walking in the near darkness. And it was fortunate because that night there was almost a full moon and some friends and I were hiking up into the woods on my friend's property. And sure enough, I start seeing the little lights and I said, guys, you won't believe this. So it was only the second time I've ever seen them before. And they're pretty rare, but they're supposed to be seen in a few locations here in Western North Carolina. And it looks like I found one of them the other day.
That's awesome. That's so exciting. Yeah, because that's one that I thought we had read while we were there actually about the lightning bugs, the fireflies, that there's like a lottery to be able to go to their habitat where they normally are in the droves. So,
yeah, the ones that I've always seen, yeah, they always, you know, usually are on private property. And that's how I've been able to see them because I've had friends who know that they appear, which is actually good because one thing you want to try and avoid is people tramping all over their, you know, their land,
right,
and potentially disturbing their habitat. So on the public areas where you can see them, you're right. People literally sign up and there's kind of a lottery to see who will get to go in and observe them. So, I mean, if you know of a location where they can be protected, that's all the better. And in both instances that I've seen them, it's been like that. I knew somebody who invited me out who said, hey, you know, we've had these on our property. Now, my friends the other day didn't know that they were on their property. I actually found them. And so now we know, but again, yeah, I think it's always best to think in terms of conservation and trying to protect the habitat of these kinds of rare creatures, even the little glowing bugs that
Absolutely.
Show up from time to time. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. So before we really get started into storytelling and stuff, would you be willing to tell our audience exactly your position in this field of weird?
Well, it's a kind of an odd position because most people kind of have their thing that they do. And I guess I'm the guy who has a lot of different hats that nobody ever sees me wearing for some reason. But, you know, I really began, I think, primarily interested in cryptozoology, I think would probably be a good catch-all term. I was just fascinated with mystery animals. When I was in grade school, my father had kind of picked up on this interest and he'd given me a couple of interesting books, which included Ivan Sanderson's Abominable Snowman, Legend Come to Life. In addition to that one, there was Peter Burns' interesting book called Bigfoot or The Search for Bigfoot. And I had those books and promptly destroyed them because I would take them out in the woods with me and I'd, you know, sit there and read them. And didn't really take good care of these old paperbacks that he passed on to me. Interestingly, I still have them. I've actually still got those and other books that they gave me. But it was from reading books like that that kind of got me interested in biology. and nature. And then that expanded into areas including man tracking, the study of what I call Fortean subjects. I got really interested in the idea of mysteries of nature and really all areas of science. So in terms of the area that I operate in today, I'm best known probably as a science and defense journalist and editor-in-chief of The Debrief, which really has very little to do with those kinds of interests. It's pretty much standard, science, defense, technology reporting. But we are probably best known in terms of the UAP subject for covering the government's involvement with that. And that's an area that I'm extremely involved in. And so really, I consider myself first and foremost a scientific proponent of the study of unidentified aerial phenomena, the artists formerly known as UFOs. But I've got all these other interests that I've really maintained since childhood, in which, of course, I get to kind of dip a toe into that field with you guys when we work with Small Town Monsters.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, doing what you're doing now, the main focus, that seems to be a hot topic right now. I mean, it's all over the news.
It really is. I remember years ago, I was doing an interview with a friend of mine. And at this time, I had a website called The Graylian Report. The website's still online. I'd started kind of writing for Fate magazine about, again, subjects like cryptozoology. And I really kind of picked up on the fact that in this modern era, really, you needed to have a website. You needed to have a blog. And so being hard-headed as I am, I bought Webspace. I didn't just sign up for a free blogger account or something. I bought a web package and started learning how to build websites because I thought, if I'm going to do it, I've got to create something that looks, distinct. And so I launched that blog, The Graylian Report, and really kind of started covering all this sort of stuff. And then wrote some books that, primarily focused on things like consciousness. But a friend during an interview early on, after one of those books came out, had said, what do you think your next contribution to all this will be? And just out of the blue, I kind of said, I think I want to sort of go in the direction of ufology, right? I mean, this was like a decade ago, but I did that. I really started looking deeply into this, became immersed in the history of it. And then having done that already for many years, I mean, really the interest in UFOs went back much further than the formal kind of entry into writing about that, blogging, contributing to magazines like UFO Magazine and a lot of other publications about that subject. In 2017, when we saw this big front page story on the New York Times talking about the DOD's interest in all this, I mean, it was shocking for me and for a lot of people because I've been involved in this really collectively for a couple of decades, and I've been writing about it professionally for 10 years or so. And I look at this and I kind of go, okay, well, there's a there, or at least there seems to be. And we're still riding that wave right now. So like you said, the current interest that we have in this subject for people who are longtime proponents of the study of this phenomenon, it's something we've been watching for a long time. And it's kind of fascinating to see the government, kind of going back and forth. Well, there is something there, but we're not sure what it is. And we're still looking for evidence of this and that. The current iteration is the DOD's All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. And again, I think that really the most important takeaway from their current investigations, which I've been a little critical of, but they maintain, look, they're about 2-5% of the cases, well over 1,000 by current estimates that we've collected from military, personnel who have encountered these things we call unidentified aerial phenomena or unidentified anomalous phenomena, they also say now. But they say 2-5 of these things we can't explain. And again, that seems to really point to that idea that's been with us for decades already. There are some phenomena that surround us in this world that we can't yet really fully explain.
Talking about how they keep changing the nomenclature for it. Like why do you think that they changed from UFO to UAP to anomalous thing? Why do they keep doing that?
It's a funny thing. That idea of UAP rather than UFO was not anything new when the 2017 article came out. Now the government had with its official investigations, and it might warrant, a very quick kind of explainer about what was happening and how it all took shape. Back around maybe as early as 2007, but really, culminating maybe in 2008 and 2009, we had a program that was run out of the Defense Intelligence Agency called the Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Application Program, or ASAP. And there was a lot of confusion when the story broke in the New York Times in 2017 because it referred to a program as ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. We now know that there was an unclassified nickname for ALSEP, and that had been ATIP. But that when the ALSEP program ended, that some of the portfolio, some of the study of these phenomena carried over in an informal capacity, and that informal effort eventually gave rise to a more formal iteration of all this called the UAP Task Force that was established under the cognizance of the Department of the Navy back, I believe, in 2020. And then after that, there was actually a bill that was passed. This was part of the National Defense Authorization Act that essentially, at the direction of Congress, established a new investigative office called AARO, or the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. Actually, it wasn't named in the legislation. That was the name that was later created for it. And that after a really, really cumbersome one, the advanced, what do they call it? Anyway, I don't remember it, but it was AIMSOG is how they pronounced it. And it, I'm sure, was intended to try and be something that would be unpronounceable and unmemorable. And, you know, and again, that kind of reflective of the government's involvement in all this. But going back to the ALSEP program, it was at that time that defense officials formally started saying, you know, we need to kind of update the names that we give to these things. And somewhere around that time, UFO preferentially began to be called UAP. But again, while some in government began to do that, there were many civilian researchers who were doing that too. In fact, if you go back and you look on my website, micahanks.com, on the blog, I have a post that I wrote back in 2015 where I refer to these things as UAP. And again, I was by no means the first person. I was simply doing that because, you know, here in Western North Carolina, we've got the Brown Mountain Lights, and, you know, you've got all these different luminous phenomena that exist in nature that were written about by William R. Corliss, who was, again, a physicist who kind of approached with a more scientific attitude the same kinds of stuff that Charles Fort was doing back at the turn of the last century in the early 1900s. You know, he was trying to write about these phenomena that smack the face of science. I've always been interested in all that stuff. And so for me, a UFO might be what appears to be a structured craft of some kind that's flying and we can't identify it. But there are all kinds of things that we would call unidentified aerial phenomena. So I think that the name preferentially began to be used by the military to expand, you know, this to mean all the different sorts of things, the true unknowns, the stuff that might be flown around in our military training ranges by China or Russia if they're trying to, you know, observe our training operations and things like that. Also some natural phenomena, plasmas, things along those lines. But there are a lot of scientists who I talk with. In fact, just this week I was talking with Robert Powell from the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, and he was saying, I prefer calling them UFOs still because, again, to me, the ones we're interested in are what appear to be objects that are flying in our air and we don't know what they are. So no matter what you call them, I think we're pretty much talking about the same thing. But again, I think that the longtime researchers still say UFO, and I do also. I kind of like that, right? So after all this UAP stuff, you might say we've come back around to UFOs revisited.
Wink, wink. Yeah. So what was the first, like, what was the first UFO story that caught your attention, even as a child, the first one that kind of got you into this field?
Well, you know, I grew up back in the 1990s. And so as a kid, you know, we had Jurassic Park and we had, you know, the Batman movies and all this stuff that, you know, as a kid, I just thought was really cool. We also had programs on TV like Unsolved Mysteries and Sightings, and they scared the crap out of me. You know, I loved watching Unsolved Mysteries with my mom and everything. And I remember my cousins and I talking about how we thought the scariest thing about it was the music, you know. But some of those shows like Sightings, I mean, they were really intense for a young viewer. And, you know, my mom always tried to be careful about letting me see too much of that stuff when I was really young, and I'd be hiding behind the couch watching anyway. She was obviously really interested in this stuff. And so some of the cases that I recall, you know, early on had been things like the Phoenix Lights. Obviously, there was Roswell, because even though that story was many decades old, in the 1990s with Unsolved Mysteries, we see this popular portrayal of the story of something crashing out there in the desert and the possibility that the government knew more than it told Americans at that time. To this day, those stories fascinate us, but those are some of the early ones that I remember. And there was another one too that I remember. We'd build the bonfires in the backyard, and it becoming evident to my parents, okay, we're not going to get him to not be interested in this, so we might as well talk about it with him and try to do so responsibly, you know, recommend some books that we can give him that he can read that are going to encourage that curiosity, but also from a scientific perspective. they were always very selective about the books that they gave me. And they would always say, okay, UFOs are cool. Now let's also study space and astronomy. Sasquatch is awesome, but let's look at all the other animals out there in the forest, the ones that we know exist, right? It was a good balance. But we'd be sitting there at the bonfire and I'd be asking questions and mother would say, okay, kid, I'll tell you a story. And one that she would talk about was the alleged abduction of Travis Walton back in the 1970s out there near Snowflake, Arizona. I've met Travis many times and, you know, it was really interesting coming from a perspective of a child hearing those stories and then decades later meeting him, talking to him about the experience and hearing him retell that story firsthand, which again is quite different from the kind of horrific portrayal that appeared in the movie that came out back in the 90s. So that was another one of those things from back in the 90s that really just kind of indelibly shook the idea of UFOs in our culture and what people perceive them as being. I can assure you the Hollywood portrayal is very different from the stories that these actual experiencers tell.
Was Travis your first experiencer that you spoke with in person?
You know, I don't know if he was the first that I ever met. I've met a lot of people over the years mm-hmm. who have shared stories and who have told experiences. I mean, going beyond just UFOs, I would say that the first experiencer of any kind of unusual phenomena that I ever spoke with was a friend of my father's who had played drums in my dad's band back in the 1960s. And my dad had always said, your Uncle Bruce, as we called him, even though he wasn't actually my uncle, but they said Bruce saw something out there in Madison County, North Carolina that he couldn't explain. And so naturally we went over there to their house once. And I was about, you know, again, in my maybe very early teens or not even that, you know, I was a kid though. And we went over there and I asked him, I said, you know, tell me about the creature you saw up there in Madison County. And he talked about this large animal that they had seen. Apparently he and his cousin were walking up to a chicken house one evening and they thought that, that there was a bear getting into this thing. And so they start making a bunch of noise to try and scare the bear away. And as it, you know, steps back and out of the chicken house, it's head and shoulders above it. It's holding eggs, whatever it is. And it walks off on two legs. And he didn't really say, I saw Bigfoot. He said, I'm not sure what this thing was. He at times sort of said it was almost like a large sloth, the way that it looked to him. He even joked with me during that first conversation. He said, for all I know, it might have been a crazy old man. But I was always fascinated by that story. And then just a few years ago, I saw him again. And after many decades, I sat down and I recorded an interview with him about that. And he told the story again. And basically all the particulars of the original story he had told were still there, still intact. And that was probably my first interview experience with somebody. But now as far as meeting well-known experiencers, yeah, Travis Walton was probably one of the first. I've met him many times over the years. And the last time I saw him, which was in the, I guess, the autumn of 2022, he and I were sitting there with some other guys having coffee one morning. And the cool thing about Travis is he doesn't come up and, you know, say, gather around, children, I've got to tell you my story. You know, he's like, he goes to these events, he gives his talk, and then he just hangs out. He just wants to be around everybody else. And he wants to talk to people about their experiences. He's still trying to figure out what happened to him. And so I took him aside at one point and I said, Travis, I have a question for you. I've never asked you about all this. And I said, you know, back in the day when all that stuff went down, can you tell me, you know, have you spoken to anybody or learned anything or come to any conclusions that might indicate what this was, what you experienced? And he essentially said, well, no, I think about that every day. And the way he framed it was really interesting. He said, obviously, their technology is so much more advanced than ours. And I've thought about, I mean, was I experiencing some sort of a holographic projection? Was I seeing some kind of a, you know, some sort of a, you know, a architect or a orchestration of some kind? He said, I still don't know what it was. I just know that I saw things that looked a lot like people. And then there were those other things that looked, I guess, what you might kind of liken to our modern idea of a gray. And he said, whatever it was they did, they didn't hurt me. They were trying to help me. But I have no idea where they're from or what their technology was. So it's fascinating that after all those years and after hearing his story as a child, he's still saying, God, I don't really know what happened. I remember, you know, the experience, and I continue to try and share that with people, hoping that maybe one day we'll all understand this a little better.
Yeah, that is something. Have you ever had an experience, an odd experience?
No, I mean, I've seen a couple of things. There were some little luminous phenomena that appeared at Brown Mountain one night when David Weatherly and I went up there. I think it was David's first time, and I took David up there, and it was really cold and there was wind blowing. And I kept thinking I was seeing these little kind of lights. And David said, man, I'm seeing these little, like just these little kind of, almost like fireflies, you'd think, except at a time of year when you'd never see those. And at that distance, they certainly were not fireflies. But David kept saying, I think I'm seeing something too. And I said, yeah, okay, that's what I'm seeing also. And I remember David saying, Mike, I'm going to be mad if you go out on an interview and you say that you didn't see anything up here this tonight, because we both just agreed that we saw something. I would maintain nonetheless that that's not probably the most spectacular display that I've ever heard about. And certainly there are good photographs that colleagues of mine have obtained at Brown Mountain that appear to depict very large globes of light and other kinds of expressions, we might say, of that luminous phenomena that occurs up there. So whatever the little lights that David and I saw, we both acknowledged it. We weren't crazy. We both saw that night. As far as like a real good UFO sighting or something like that, I've never seen anything. And I think, unfortunately, one of the reasons, or fortunately, maybe one of the reasons for that is because when I began to really seriously study this stuff, again, this going back to the things my parents would tell me as a child, okay, cool. UFOs are great, but space and astronomy are really cool too. You know, the toolkit that a UFO investigator should always have open should involve the apps, you know, with, again, we've got these portable multifunction devices that we all carry around in our pockets these days. You've got apps that'll help you identify virtually any celestial object, most satellites, virtually any aircraft that's flying overhead. And you can do other things too, because there are a lot of sensory capabilities that those, you know, smartphones possess. If you are able to obtain a photograph, there's EXIF data, you know, you can get this information about latitude and longitude, time of day, you know, and other things that can help you conduct an investigation after the fact. So with those tools in mind, yeah, I've had a couple of near misses where I thought I was looking at something really cool, and it became abundantly clear to me that it was a star, or it was an Iridium satellite that, as it was turning in orbit, it was reflecting light and appeared to be flashing. And the cool thing about this is that having had those experiences where I initially thought I saw something, I mean, the first time I saw the International Space Station flying overhead, I literally thought it was a UFO. But I reached out to a friend at NASA, and they said, yep, based on its trajectory at the time, it would have been clearly visible and reflecting sunlight from just over the horizon as it passed over Asheville, North Carolina. You saw the space station, buddy. So those experiences kind of helped me discern, okay, here's how to investigate, here are the things to look for, and here's how you would identify a genuine unknown. So far, I haven't had one of those real good unknown experiences yet.
What is something that you've read about in the news lately, astronomical news, that you're most excited about as far as things that we're discovering or things that have been discovered, going down a more scientific route? What's super exciting these days?
Well, now I'll just say I maintain that interest in the sort of fringes of biology, right? There's some compelling footage that has surfaced in recent years that is suggestive that maybe some variety of seal or creature could maybe still be hanging around parts of South Florida, maybe something akin to a monk seal. The Caribbean monk seal, I believe, probably was last seen in the 1950s. But when footage emerges as recently as, you know, the new millennium, that seems to show an animal consistent with that in that habitat, I mean, that's really exciting. But you know, extending to space and astronomy, I would say one of the most interesting things is how, with the advent of the James Webb Space Telescope, we're looking further and further out into space than we've ever looked. And some of the things we're seeing do not necessarily match our predictions based on models of the universe. You know, we have this idea due to the fact that with the, ever since the Big Bang, as the universe continues to expand, that, you know, we should be able to account for the dynamics of the universe. And yet there are a lot of missing pieces, things that don't make sense. And because of that, of course, we postulate the existence of a non-luminous material like dark matter would have to be inferred, even though we can't see it. We have to infer that it's out there in order to, you know, for the universe to make sense in terms of our current understanding based on relativity and really all of physics. But as we look further out into space with the help of the James Webb Space Telescope, we're noticing that as galaxies form, they don't look like we would expect them to look that far away. And the important thing to remember about galaxies at that distance is the time that it takes for light to travel across vast distances throughout the universe means that the galaxies that we see through the imagery collected by Webb depicts these galaxies as they would have appeared a long time ago. And so we expected naturally that we would see these galaxies. Again, they don't look like this now, but the light that's reaching Earth right now for the first time we're seeing would show them how they looked a long time ago and therefore in an earlier stage of their galactic formation. Curiously, they don't really look like we thought that they would. They actually look much older. And so astronomers and astrophysicists are looking at all this new data saying, okay, what does that mean? Which is really exciting to me because rather than saying, oh God, we've got an unknown and now it doesn't match our models and everything's going to go all to hell, you know, I'm looking at that going, well, this is cool because, you know, I think it's really good for us to have to challenge our views and to have to kind of accept that at times our models don't always predict everything correctly, that we don't always get everything right, and that we may have to rethink the things that we think we know so well about the universe so that we can kind of adjust. Because when you do that, inevitably, it leads to new discoveries and insights. You know, I'm still kind of on the fence about the idea of dark matter, that there's all this luminous stuff out there holding the universe together that we just mysteriously can't see and can't find. Then again, I'm not a physicist. You talk to a lot of physicists and they say, you know, we know it's out there and we are getting closer and closer through the study of things like, you know, bizarre particles like neutrinos and things. We're getting much closer to, you know, getting to a point where we'll be able to detect it and we're going to really kind of unfurl some of these mysteries associated with it. But there is always that alternative. I mean, that maybe that's sort of a placeholder and that there's a problem with the way we're observing the universe. And maybe we don't need things like dark matter to explain those mysteries. And it could be, it's yet to be proven, but again, it could be that as we look out there with Webb and we make these observations that are seemingly counterintuitive, it's going to help us figure out whatever the real reality is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And having that open mind, I think, is something that we should have even in cryptozoology, in the study of the field and everything, to keep what we perceive as truth now or truth now to not necessarily be the way that it is until we have more data to confirm this.
Oh, 100%. I mean, again, you think about all of the discoveries that have been made and, you know, the relative recency of a lot of those just in the areas of, you know, zoology. Everybody kind of points to the discovery of the mountain gorilla as being one of these things where the initial stories of what at the time people would have viewed as being essentially a very human-like animal, right? Some descriptions might have even said that these were like, you know, mountain giants. They're more like people than other animals that we see. And the first reports start coming back to the West and people say, oh, nonsense, there couldn't be an animal like that. And then a specimen's brought back, right? And sure enough, we know, okay, these things really are down there. And then we can look back in time and we begin to realize, okay, a lot of the stories that travelers told centuries ago that we chalked up just to being folklore and legends, well, they make a whole lot more sense in light of these new discoveries. And you look at some of those stories, like I think it was 1848, the HMS Daedalus, was sailing and they observe off the African coast, I believe is where they were sailing at that time, near the Cape of Good Hope, I think. Captain Peter McQuay and his crew see this creature that by all intents and purposes sounds like a sea serpent, right? The sea serpent of myth and legend. The descriptions that were given by McQuay and his officers variously described the thing as looking sort of lizard-like. Some said it was more like a serpent, but they really, none of them could see exactly how it was moving through the water, whether there were flippers or whether it was moving its tail or, you know, some other kind of means of propulsion through the water. But they all agreed there was a long neck with a quote, sort of snake or turtle-like head. And this thing was looking around as it's sailing past our boat. And we all got a good look at this thing. And it was a controversial sighting because it appeared in the English newspapers at the time. There was a lot of pushback, naturally, from naturalists who said, no, you couldn't have possibly seen a sea serpent. We know those don't exist, do we? I think about a number of other incredible sightings, and particularly some that have occurred up off the Pacific West Western coast. Paul LeBlanc, the late zoologist, wrote a really fascinating paper about this where he delved deeply into sightings of not always long-necked creatures, but just animals that were unrecognized by, you know, conventional scientific knowledge of, you know, the animals that exist particularly up there off the western coast. Some of them were long-necked and, again, were pretty good matches for the idea of a sea serpent. But the fact that there is so much information available based on primarily anecdotal accounts provided by witnesses, to me, strongly suggests that even if they aren't all correct, people have been seeing something. And so the question to me really is, okay, do those animals still exist? We know that they existed at one point, if, again, these sightings are to be believed. But again, I would say that the amount of sightings and the similarity in descriptions that are provided over time strongly suggests that there is some sort of an animal out there. And if I could share with you really the craziest story along those lines, I'll just throw this in here. I mean, this was nothing from, you know, earlier times. This was from back in the 1980s. There was a group of, California highway workers working up there above Stinson Beach. And they all saw this great big thing swimming out in the water. And years ago, I'd written an article about this, and I was sort of skeptical, I guess. You know, I mean, it was described as like a great big 100-foot-long, basically, sea serpent. And I'm always open to the possibility, but I was sort of skeptical. And so a couple of researchers from California reached out to me, and they said, you know, Marlene Martin, one of the primary witnesses who was named in the newspaper articles at the time that reported this, you know, she's still around. She would talk to you. And so they put me in touch with her, and I remember I conducted the interview through an email. I sent her a series of questions. I said, did you see any hair on the creature? How long was it? And she said explicitly, there was absolutely no hair. It was a giant snake. And the way she described it, I'll never forget. She said, the head was sort of like an alligator in the sense that it was a little longer, but essentially it was a giant snake. She said that the teeth were, you know, trianguloid, like if you ever look at an alligator's teeth. She said the teeth were just like that. She said that as it was swimming along, it swam with its mouth open, which gave it an almost playful appearance, and that it had a large round eye. And she said that the DOT workers that she was with, Matt Ratto, I think was one of their names, and I could probably remember the others, but give me another coffee. Anyway, they're all standing there, and they're passing around binoculars, and they're looking at this thing. And so she, like her colleagues they're working with her, they all got a really good look at this thing through the binoculars. And I'll never forget how she said this in the email she wrote. It was extremely eerie to watch this animal. And I never let my children back out there in the waters off Stinson Beach ever again. So I talked about this on my podcast and talked about the exchange with Marlene Martin. And lo and behold, a week later, I get an email from a guy saying, I remember this. He said, I lived right there near Stinson Beach back in the 1980s. And he said, I remember that day we were all stuck in traffic and the DOT workers were out there and I saw this big commotion and I pulled up wanting to ask what was going on, what they kept looking at down in the water. And they said they'd seen some sort of a large animal down there. And they're by no means the only people who have seen that in that general vicinity. So again, stories like that, even from just a few decades ago, they really cause me to think that there's a whole lot more to our world than we think we do. And again, past discoveries plainly show that every time we think we've got a good handle on things and we've found all the large animals, oh, there's definitely other stuff out there.
Yeah, that we recently had done an interview with someone who was mentioning the folklore, like ancient folklore, and how we see that often as just stories, like you said, but then recent fossil record discoveries or things like that can prove that these stories actually had something behind them at some point, like these large serpents. Everybody has a story of a large serpent in their religion, or in various folk tales. And here we have evidence of larger serpents or the large creatures, the megafauna.
Oh yeah. I spent a lot of time down in Brazil and they tell stories like that down there too, Heather. You know, they say that, for instance, one of the names, I think one of the indigenous names that they have for large snakes is, are trying to remember, dormi something, because they say it makes a strange noise as it sleeps. And, yeah. But one of the names translates to mean the mother of the river, which always fascinated me. I mean, it seems to describe an extremely large snake. Now, there really was recently an interesting discovery made down there in a part of Brazil that I've never been to. Actually, I think the discovery was made in Ecuador. But again, these traditions often extend beyond just a particular region. And so in the Ecuadorian Amazon, they actually found a very large variety of green anaconda that they think might be a good match for descriptions of snakes by indigenous natives that are much larger than the ones that, again, science currently recognizes. But again, like you said, if you look back at the fossil record, I think just last week I read a report about another massive, snake that, again, this is only known in the fossil record. It doesn't exist today, but certainly there were very large snakes back in the day here on Earth, and we find them in the fossil record. So it's not impossible to me that in a habitat that would be conducive to those animals feeding themselves, you know, water that they can move through, which makes it easier for them to move. You know, those river systems in parts of Brazil, Ecuador, and other parts of South America certainly could still have some very large snakes. And again, stories like those told by Percy Fawcett, he said that he and his crew encountered a snake so massive it was like 75 feet long and they shot it and killed it. A lot of people hear that story and say, I don't know, that's a pretty big snake. It might be an exaggeration, but that's not to say that there aren't at least some credible stories that do suggest, and also indigenous traditions that are strongly suggestive of larger species of aquatic reptiles down there, or not just aquatic reptiles. But again, these snakes seemingly move both on land and on water. And that being both for purposes, I would argue, of travel, but also primarily because they have food sources that are readily available in those kinds of areas.
Right. Absolutely. So bringing it back to your childhood, I'm curious, do you have storytellers in your family, or are you, because you're definitely a storyteller. I'm sure you've never heard that before. do you have storytellers in your family? Like, did you inherit this gift?
Well, you know, my mom did tell a lot of stories around the campfire. And at times my dad did too. Now, again, the way our family was kind of structured back in the day, my father, who's really a Renaissance man, he was doing everything from teaching music to studying and teaching martial arts. He was a professional photographer. He ended up getting a real estate license. Eventually, he ended up actually becoming an Episcopal priest, of all things. And then he retired from that and he went and joined the Masons. And so he's still very interested in a variety of different esoteric subjects. But he also worked as a teacher of Latin language. He taught strings, you know, violin and viola, cello, in the high school system here in our region. So I was introduced to a lot of those kinds of interests, music, language, things like that from my father, history, you know, biology. My mom, on the other hand, she being the stay-at-home mom and who worked from home as an artist and produced beautiful paintings and all kinds of, you know, interesting sculptures and things along those lines, she had more time one-on-one with the kids, you know, at home. And so that's why I think I remember mom being more of the storyteller. Both my parents maybe to an extent have that. And, you know, when I was a kid on the musical side of things, a musician who's really well known in our region, who my father would often perform with and actually as a recording artist performed on a lot of his albums, was Grammy Award winner David Holt. And David literally lives just a couple of mountain ridges over from where I'm currently based here in East Asheville. But David Holt is really probably a world-renowned storyteller. And I remember we had vinyl albums of David's, you know, some of them, the music albums my dad had actually performed on, you know, playing guitar, banjo, and other instruments. But David would do these storytelling albums too. And one of the stories that he did a really good version of was The Hairy Man, right? And he, there was also a Talipo, which is the story about this kind of a creature, you know, that is moving around under this guy's cabin and everything. And he cuts its tail off and uses that to make a stew. And the creature comes back to get its tail, right? So these kinds of stories, obviously folk tales, and not intended to be taken as, you know, real depictions of events or anything like that. You know, David definitely had a flair for good storytelling. And would travel all over the world to tell those stories. So I was exposed to some of David's storytelling early on too. And you might say that that was a bit of an influence because many years later when I was a young adult, I'd say in my early 20s, David actually called me up a couple of times and I did a few performances with him. And when we would be on stage, even if we were doing a musical performance, David is always telling the story. He's very much a musicologist. And he would be telling the story of, you know, Appalachian traditions that led to the creation of some rather novel instruments and things like that. And he would demonstrate how to play these instruments for kids and things like that at schools. But as he is performing, he's incorporating storytelling into the music side of things too. And as I've already revealed, I'm also a musician. I play a lot of, you know, mostly acoustic music on the weekends and things, but I think it all just kind of mashes together the music and storytelling interest from early in life. And it's definitely still a part of who I am today.
That's awesome. What do you think there is about music in particular that allows storytelling to become such a natural fit together? And always has been, really.
That's a really good question. I'll tell you what I think it really involves is back in time. You know, humans, we have a tendency to lock in on rhythms, right? And you can observe what we might call rhythms in nature, but you know, if you ever have gone and sat by a stream, if you're by a little waterfall and water falling against a rock, it can create a rhythmic, you know, kind of a you know, experience. And we'll spot those sorts of rhythms. And when you identify that, it's funny because, you know, we tend to move to rhythm, right? You know, we recognize rhythm. If a song comes on that we like, that's the more obvious example. You know, we hear music that we like and we start, you know, rocking out. But I'm sure that early humans, before we had, you know, stereo systems and things, and we were producing music like that, we were drawn to rhythm. And we began to realize that when we put stories to rhythm, it helped us to remember those stories. And so it's really interesting because early chants and poetry and things along those lines, epic ballads, those to me, and this is probably one of the reasons why a lot of early songs dealt with things like death, with, you know, stories of creation, you know, real life events, things that happened. In Southern Appalachian folklore, we still have a lot of songs that tell the story of trains. They tell the story of robberies. They tell the stories of fights. You know, they tell the stories of, you know, all kinds of things. They talk about, you know, famous families. And so the storytelling tradition is really a good fit for music in the sense that music, when you put that lyric to rhythm and also to music, you're more likely to remember it. You can remember the story. And I think that whether or not that was intended, it may have just been something that happened, but ultimately the result is that storytelling through repetition and rhythm gave rise to, over time, oral traditions that have preserved knowledge, right? And so I think it's fascinating when you look at these stories of things like flood myths, and I'm talking about like in cultures all around the world, the belief that at some point in the ancient past, there was a massive flood, right? It's sort of a controversial idea because I think a lot of people directly equate it with religion and other things like that. I'm not necessarily talking about that. I'm just saying oral traditions that describe, you know, flood myths and other things, there's probably a reason why those persist. And so again, for those oral traditions to sort of continue and our knowledge of these ancient events, because I actually happen to think that probably back around the time of, you know, the end of the last ice age, as we were emerging from the Pleistocene and entering the Holocene and the earth is gradually warming again, there was probably a large amount of glacial meltwater runoff that both it ran off into the oceans, it ran off into the landscape at times. And this might have been something that ancient people recognized as a kind of flood. And there are a lot of theories about what exactly could have happened that would have instigated that transitional period at that time. But again, that's a discussion for another time. The point is, I think that those verbal traditions have been preserved. And I think that rhythm and music kind of helps to preserve those ideas. And that's been a very effective way of kind of preserving our history over time.
Absolutely. Well, it is close to the end of the show. And I always ask my guests to tell me a story. And I would normally narrow down the parameters here, but I can tell that you have stories from all over the place that you could share. So would you be willing to share with me a story? It could be anything related to the world of weird that's just always got your attention, maybe since you were younger, just one of your favorite stories to reminisce and tell around a campfire, if you could.
Yeah, that's tricky. I mean, it's like, what story would you pick? You know, I mean, right, I've already told exactly a bunch of stories and then I think, oh gosh, now I've got to think of one. Yeah. But one that really comes to mind, actually, I'll kind of, you know, marry a couple of these together. In my own family, there are some interesting traditions involving, you know, strange experiences that family members had had. One had been that my my father's dad, who we called Papaw when I was a kid, he was basically the man of the house at a very early age. And the reason why is because his father, who worked in the mills in South Carolina, had died rather mysteriously. He had been working really hard, and it was extremely hot, of course, in the mill. Anybody who's ever been to kind of, you know, mid-state South Carolina in the summer, you'll know how hot it can get down there. And so he'd been working in a mill all day, and he came home and drank a whole lot of water very quickly. And then he started experiencing health problems, and ultimately he ended up dying very soon after that at a relatively young age. And so his son, you know, again, my dad's dad, who wasn't very old at the time, he was essentially having to go to work, never really got to have much of a childhood. The story is that, interestingly, right before his father passed away, he had been walking home from work one night and had seen some sort of a strange light. And this strange light just kind of disperses like that. And he came home and he talked about it. And naturally, he dies just a few days later. And so the kind of superstitions at the time had been that he had observed some sort of an omen and that this precipitated his death, whatever the light was. And there's a long tradition of linking aerial phenomena to, you know, misfortune or viewing it as being a portent of, you know, things to come. If I were to speculate, one reason for that might be that we see things like earthlights that appear prior to, for instance, earthquakes. And we still sort of are getting a handle on why that happens, but it's obviously some kind of geophysical phenomena. Earthlights have been photographed and filmed on video as well in recent years. And so we know that happens and that there's probably a very simple natural explanation for it that involves plasmas as a result of tectonic, you know, stress that, or seismic, you know, stresses that are induced during and sometimes prior to or even after a seismic event like that. But we could speculate that, you know, ancient people might have seen those lights and thought, oh, you know, okay, I've seen those before. And last time I saw those, an earthquake happened right afterward and a bunch of people died. So that might be one reason that, you know, there are long traditions involving associations between lights and misfortune. But one more story I'll share from the other side of the family came from my mom's side, where her grandfather had been walking home one night, and he said this little dog comes up and starts walking alongside him. And he likes this little dog, cute little guy. And he keeps walking along. And as the dog gets toward the end of this fence that it's running alongside, it stops and it starts running back. And so next night, same thing happens. The same little dog comes up and it's running alongside this fence with him and everything. And he likes this little guy, cute little dog. So several nights later, this continues to happen, and the little dog runs right up to him one night. And so he reaches down. He hadn't actually pet the dog. The little guy would just come up and kind of run alongside him. So he sees this little dog again this third or fourth night, and he reaches down to pet the dog. And as he told it, he said, my hand went straight through its head, just like it was not there. I mean, he said, this little guy was a ghost dog. That was a story that our my great-grandfather, Cordell, would have told. And, you hear a lot of these kind of stories, but, yeah, he was convinced that that little dog had been somebody's dog at some time, but was no longer among the living when he met it.
Aw, that's adorable, though.
The tale of a ghost dog.
Yes, a tale of a ghost dog, and a friendly one at that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being part of this episode. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you and follow along with everything that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest place to look is just micahhanks.com. You can find my podcasts linked right there. And of course, there's also information about all the other projects that I'm involved with. There are quite a few, but all that information is available right there.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much. And as always, guys, you can send me an email, heather@smalltownmonsters.com. And until next time.
Presented by the Small Town Monsters Broadcasting Network. You can find out more about this and other network shows, as well as Small Town Monsters films, books, and Monster Fest 2 at smalltownmonsters.com.